From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. So, the president stepped up to the plate, took his first big swing, and missed. The GOP majority could not come together to repeal or replace Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act stands, even as Republicans claim it's failing. So now what? For American health care and the rest of the Trump agenda, tax reform and right on down, this hour On Point, President Trump and his party, the health care debacle, and what comes next? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What happened to the GOP's health care push? Who do you blame? The hard right, the Democrats, Paul Ryan, the president himself? How do you think Trump will do in the future? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. At On Point Radio, Friday was quite a day. We haven't seen something like that in a long time in legislative and executive America. Here was Speaker of the House Paul Ryan on Friday announcing his party was withdrawing its long-awaited health care bill, admitting that his party, the GOP, wasn't used to governing.
Moving from an opposition party to a governing party comes with growing pains. And, well, we're feeling those growing pains today. We came really close today, but we came up short. I spoke to the president just a little while ago, and I told him that the best thing I think to do is to pull this bill, and he agreed with that decision.
How bad was it? Well, bad.
I will not sugarcoat this. This is a disappointing day for us. Doing big things is hard. All of us, myself included, we will need time to reflect on how we got to this moment, what we could have done to do it better.
And the president's instinct in the aftermath, here it was.
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now.
Okay, great. Later this hour, we'll look at Trump and energy plans. But first, let's go right to what happened Friday and what it means looking forward. Joining me from Washington is Mary Agnes Carey, Partnership Senator, Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also from Washington, Sahil Kapoor joins us, national political reporter for Bloomberg. Sahil, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Great to be back.
Bottom line, I know there was all the maneuvering and all the fighting, but what happened here to Donald Trump's leadership, the leadership on the Hill, and this health care push the Republicans have talked about for years, Sahil?
Tom, this was a shared failure on a variety of levels. It was a failure from the White House. They vastly underestimated how difficult it would be to overhaul what is essentially one-sixth of the economy. Remember, liberals took a century of trying to pass universal health care, something resembling universal health care or a national health care program. And this Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act law, was designed to be very, very difficult to undo. This was also a failure of Speaker Paul Ryan. His job is to know what the politics in his conference are. They overcame him. He did not foresee, number one, that he would be facing the level of opposition from the right flank, specifically the Freedom Caucus. And more than that, he did not expect to face opposition from moderates who are flexing their muscle in a way that we had not seen throughout the Obama presidency, and complaining that some of these provisions are too far to the right, that they would harm their constituents. Things like the big Medicaid cuts, things like reductions in tax subsidies, especially for older Americans. So this was a failure on a variety of levels. And I think what many House Republicans told me after the vote echoed what Speaker Ryan said, but they were more stark about it. They don't know how to govern, and they need to learn quickly.
I mean, it hasn't been that long. It's not as though they haven't had majorities before. I know fingers are pointing all over the place, but where, Sahil, are the biggest fingers pointing today in terms of who blew it?
It's a good question. The president is pointing his finger at the Freedom Caucus, the Republican leadership. Paul Ryan has not publicly gone after them, but Republican leadership members are very upset with them. Their view is that they moved the goalposts and they couldn't get to yes. The Freedom Caucus is blaming leadership and the moderates for pushing something, you know, less than a full repeal of the Affordable Care Act, because in their view, this is what they promised their constituents, and they don't want to vote for legislation that isn't pure to that promise. So again, it's a failure on a variety of levels, and we'll see where this goes. This is a big setback for President Trump.
How could Paul Ryan not know that he had the Freedom Caucus sitting there? They've been sitting right there for years, you know, and you know their position. How could he not know that he had moderates who wouldn't be willing to saw people off and let them fall off the cliff here?
throughout the Obama presidency, Tom, Republicans got very good at obstructing. They got very good at opposing. They turned it into an art form on you know, in a number of ways. Now, there are dozens and dozens of Republicans, particularly in the House, who got elected specifically on the promise of smashing the status quo and obstructing the Obama agenda. The idea of governing with a president in your own party with majorities in Congress is foreign to them. It's a new concept. And, you know, again, Speaker Ryan, as recently as the Bush era, was one of, you know, was kind of a rabble rouser from the right. A lot of those people, the people from that era who were, you know, what today's Republican Study Committee or Freedom Caucus were, are now running the place. And it's a learning curve for all of them.
And what about the White House and the president? I mean, Maureen Dowd was just scorching this weekend, writing about Donald Trump. She said, "You sold yourself as the businessman. Man who could shake things up and make Washington work again. Instead, you got worked over by the Republican leadership and the business community." She writes, "They're counting on you being a delusional dupe who didn't even know what was in the bill because you're sitting around in a bathrobe getting your information from wackadoodles on Fox News. You got played." Maureen Dowd there on the president. Talk about scorching. How's the White House responding? What do we know about how Donald Trump is responding?
Tom, this is one of the reasons this is so painful for President Trump. He had sold himself as a great negotiator, the great deal maker throughout the campaign, someone who could overcome problems in Washington by his sheer competence and get things done. And it wasn't only that. It was Republican leaders, including Speaker Ryan and including his lieutenants, repeatedly sold Trump as the closer, the deal maker, the ultimate closer. You can go back and look at what they said. Just to look at it now, it's quite stark, the contrast between how they sold this and what ended up happening. And it remains mystifying to me that 7 years of promises to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, dozens and dozens of votes over the last 6 years. They won the House, they won the Senate, they won the White House while campaigning on this. 3 weeks, it all came crashing down. Are they going to give this up without a vote? It seems like it right now.
And then what does it mean for the rest of the Trump agenda? But healthcare is a pretty big thing in and of itself. Sal Kapoor with Bloomberg Standby. Mary Agnes Carey, you were with us last week and did some terrific explaining on what was in there, on what the Republican bill would mean. Now it's not happening at all. It collapsed on Friday. And the president is saying, we heard him right there in the tape, Obamacare is exploding, and kind of saying, let's let it explode. Is it exploding? If Republicans do nothing or give it a nudge, does it just blow up, Mary Agnes?
Couple things to consider. The Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan scorekeeper for Washington, said in an analysis of the Republican plan and looking at the current ACA marketplace that either way, whether the current marketplace stayed in place or the Republican plan were adopted, that markets would be stable in most areas. That's the first thing to think about.
Well, most areas could leave 49%, you know, in trouble. I mean, everybody needs health care.
Right. Everybody needs health care. But you have seen, we've talked about this before, you've seen some premium increases in rural areas. Urban areas tend to have more competition to keep things lower. I think looking ahead, what I'm thinking about is what will happen to the marketplaces. You have insurers involved now, obviously, with the House Republican plan off the table. And Speaker Ryan and President Trump seem they don't want to go anywhere near health care now. What will be the insurance market reaction? The plans that are there, will they stay? Will they look at the thought was this price jump we saw in 2017, that average increase in the federal marketplaces, which are about three dozen states, the average price bump was 25%. Some places higher, some places lower. Yep. Was that a one-time anomaly? Because you knew the sickest people would get in first. So how will this mitigate the market? And also, how will the marketplaces be managed at the Department of Health and Human Services? Let's not forget when Speaker Ryan was trying to sell this bill to his caucus, he talked about a three-pronged strategy.
Right.
The second prong was at HHS with Tom Price at the helm, how he would leverage the power in the Affordable Care Act to shape that. Will he use some of that? Will he define things in a different way that are possibly favorable or unfavorable? That's kind of unclear, but there are a lot of variables to watch going forward. But the threat of this repeal being off the table does take some pressure off of what may happen next year.
Yeah, but I want to dig in here. Help us understand, if Obamacare goes ahead, let's say just on its current path on autopilot, and nobody does anything,
right,
does it explode as the president suggests? If it's in trouble, or here's another path, could the Trump administration actually push it toward explosion? if they figured that would ultimately be better for them somehow or help them get to a successor plan. Are there things that they could do administratively or legislatively to, you know, like tweaks that are necessary to save it that they could withhold or active measures they could take to
sure.
push it off the cliff?
Let's talk about a few of those potential items, right? There are cost-sharing subsidies in the law that help people at about 250% of poverty or higher.
Yeah.
That's around an income about 30 grand
mm-hmm.
to help with your co-pays and deductibles, right? Those
yeah.
are additional money in a company that accompany the money given to help lower the premium cost. Let's say Congress said, we're not going to appropriate the $8 or $9 billion for that. They could do that, but then what would happen if people don't get cost-sharing? They can't afford coverage. That causes problems in the market. Will Republicans get blamed? Will Democrats get blamed? Obviously, each side is pointing their finger at the other, but that's one potential thing. Secondly, some provisions of the Affordable Care Act were put in through regulation. For
mm-hmm.
example, HHS could easily throw out rules that require plans to offer contraceptive coverage at no additional cost to consumers, right?
Yeah,
that means
yeah.
no out-of-payment, out-of-pocket co-payment. That doesn't topple the law, but it creates a ripple effect. It creates a problem. They could reinterpret, they being HHS, could reinterpret some of the essential health benefits, these things that are mandated to be covered, you know, pregnancy, maternity services, emergency service, that kind of thing. But they could shape that so perhaps they're not as generous or insurers are not required to do as much. Now, granted, those things happen in a way that advocates of the law think are an overreach of HHS. They can take them to court. But nonetheless, there's an ability there at HHS to shape this.
Sahil, in a word, is the GOP ready to let it fail, help it fail?
I think their belief is it will fail. They don't want it to succeed. And if it fails, the Democrats will be blamed. But I'm not sure when this has ever worked.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point, and we're looking at what's next after the GOP's healthcare failure for the Trump agenda and for Obamacare. You can join us this hour. Are you still shaking your head in amazement at the Friday meltdown, the GOP's healthcare flameout? What do you want now? For Obamacare to be fixed? Who's going to do that? What about the man who said, I alone can fix it? Can Donald Trump find a GOP unity on the rest of his agenda? And will, should Democrats work with him on tax reform, on infrastructure? Here was President Trump at the White House on Friday saying, oh, if you only had some Democrats in on it.
We were very close. It was a very, very tight margin. We had no Democrat support. We had no votes from the Democrats. They weren't going to give us a single vote, so it's a very difficult thing to do.
Of course, there were no Republicans who came in to help on Obamacare. Quite the contrary. Nobody expected Democrats, I guess, this time. Republicans had the majority but could not do it. Here was Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer on ABC's This Week with a tough diagnosis on why the president couldn't pass his health care bill.
The president exhibited two traits that are not very helpful, and if he repeats them in tax reform, they'll get nowhere. The first is basic lack of competence. You cannot run the presidency like you run a real estate deal. You can't tweet your way through it. You can't threaten and intimidate and say, I'll walk away. It's more complicated. But even more to the point, the president campaigned as a populist against the Democratic and Republican establishments, but he's been captured by the hard right, wealthy special interests.
Sahil Kapoor is with us from Bloomberg News, Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser Health News, and lots of callers on this. Yellow Springs, Ohio. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. So Donald Trump is a deal maker, and he's engineered a variety of real estate deals, some of which have taken years, but none of them have been at the scale of the health care plan. None of them has approached being a $1 trillion deal. So if he has experience taking several years to pull a multi-million dollar deal or a $1 billion deal together.
It's still peanuts compared to this, yeah.
That's right. And indeed, that's what the Obama administration did. They took a year and a half to knit this thing together and to make it nuanced and sophisticated.
So what do you take from the Trump approach, Mike? What do you take from it?
Well, I think the comment from Chuck Schumer said it all. I mean, and at the beginning, Chuck Schumer said, if there are things that they want to do to fix the Affordable Care Act, we'll work with, and there are things we can get behind, we will vote for it. So, you know, Donald Trump right now is whining that he didn't get any Democratic votes. That's just because there was nothing that the Democrats could vote for in good conscience. And again, Chuck Schumer just said that what you played, that let's work together to fix the Affordable Care Act and make it better.
Mike, let us look at both parts of that, and I appreciate your call from Yellow Springs. Sahil, what about it first? Why was the timeline so short here? Who did think that they could cobble this together in 3 weeks and come out with something good that would pass? And now on the other side of that, the Democrats didn't get in here. They sat on their hands on this. If they wanted to get in and try and fix Obamacare, would there be enough Republicans out there, the moderates you described, who might jump in with them to do that? Or are they going to be told no way, no how by the White House or by Paul Ryan?
Firstly, Tom, let's remember this is something Republicans had tried to work on for the last 7 years, the act of coming up with a replacement plan that the party could unify around, and they failed every step of the way. They never came up with a replacement plan that had anything close to consensus. It was always going to be a problem. They should not have underestimated this, and I think once they won the White House and they realized that they actually had an opportunity to legislate here, they tried to put something together as fast as they could. This was probably... it's unclear to me that they could have put something together that satisfied all wings of their caucus. It was a monumental task. To our caller's point a moment ago, this is one congressman, Representative Bill Huizenga of Michigan, a Republican, said this to me. It was a good point. This is a learning curve for Donald Trump. He said, I'm quoting here, my guess is he has learned through this process that politics is different from business. There's no ability to sit at a table and say you're fired, unquote. That's point number one. The second thing is about Democrats potentially working with Republicans. Look, Democrats pretty much widely agree that this law has a lot of problems. They've been defensive about it because Republicans want to strip away these benefits and they want to strip away the good things about it. And Democrats are not going to go along with that. So they tend to, they have tended to stand against Republican efforts every step of the way. There is theoretically a situation where Democrats could come to the table if it means fixing parts of the market that don't work, doing something about all the many counties that Republicans actually point out that have only one insurer, doing something about price hikes in rural areas, especially, given the lack of competition. If Republicans decide to do that, then I think there is some potential for cooperation. But I don't see that at the moment. I think nerves are still raw. Republicans are not ready to accept that this is going to be the law of the land, even if on some level they realize it. So I think we're a ways away from that. And I think HHS Secretary Tom Price will have the largest role going forward in what he can do administratively.
Laura in Atlanta, Georgia. You're on, Laura. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do not think Democrats should work with any of them. Mitch McConnell said obstruct, obstruct, obstruct when Obama got elected. And they did that to us for 8 years. They voted against us on everything, no matter what it was, and we should return the favor.
But Laura, that's easy to say, but this is about grandma's cancer. This is about real people and their troubles. If you've got the markets, in trouble in some parts of this country and it could endanger health care for people, is that not a circumstance? If Republicans would come around to doing some fixing here, why not watch that carefully and Democrats look at potentially working with them to do that?
Well, for one, because they won't. There's no way in God's green earth the Republicans are going to work with us on anything because they never do. But also, you know what? I think Obamacare is working. It's working for the people that I know. So I think there's a lot of red flags raised up and, oh, my God, the world is ending. You know what? I don't think it is. I think it's working better than it has in years.
Laura, thanks
and
for
even
thank
my own thing for. Oh, yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
We got it. I appreciate your call, Mary Agnes. There again, true or false? I mean, it matters for individual people and their lives. You know, if the Congress can just sit back and let it roll, or if somebody needs to get in there and work on it to prevent people from suffering.
You've got 22 million people between the Medicaid expansion and the Affordable Care Act and those who've purchased on the exchanges that are getting health coverage through this law. Republicans have said repeatedly they didn't want to force anybody off their coverage. They don't want to cause any problems. Now, they were saying that in the context of trying to pass their own solution, which they can't at this point, right? So a really defining moment, I think, for Republicans on health care is how they proceed in the next year. We talked about the cost-sharing subsidies. Do they take care of that? Do they fully fund the next enrollment cycle? Let's remember that before open enrollment closed at the end of January, this administration pulled back advertising, which was traditionally done near the end of the enrollment period and particularly targeted to young people.
And if you don't market to get people in there, the whole thing works much less well.
People work on deadlines. It's not just reporters. A lot of people wait to the last minute to do things. And so when those ads were pulled back, that was part of the thinking and why they didn't hit that 13 million enrollment, which was the target. So how do Republicans want to do this? What will they do? You know, there's been this discussion you're talking about it, Democrats, Republicans working together in the ACA. I personally don't see that happening, at least right now, probably not for a long time. It's too nuclear. But it's, you know, it gets to the heart of governing. What is governing? Is it to come up with solutions? Is it to obstruct and wait for more of your own people to show up? People define it different ways, but that is definitely a question I think that's on the table.
Kyle in Stowe, Massachusetts. Kyle, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
My comment has sort of shifted a little bit. I initially was going to say it's pretty baffling that President Trump would just let this thing explode in the faces of the American people. And that sort of goes into my new comment, which is that I think the government has forgotten about this social compact that citizens provide take money for this government and expect services and expect a working government. And all of that feels to me like it's gone out the window. And I just think that's the problem with government right now.
But Kyle, you've got the Freedom Caucus saying take less money and expect fewer government services. That's not their vision for America.
I think, unfortunately, the American population and our country is too large for that kind of thinking. If it was a smaller country with less people, with less diversity, with less, you know, complicated issues, then yes, that viewpoint works. Otherwise, you know, unfortunately, I think we're a huge country and we have lots of things happening in it. And, you know, the government should be in some form and fashion working to provide effective services, whether it's healthcare or social welfare. Various programs, law enforcement, education.
Yeah. Kyle, we got it, and I appreciate your call as well. Sal, may I bring that to you? Because over the weekend, we had the president suggesting that it was the Republican right wing that had undermined him here, and with that kind of reminding the country that he campaigned as a populist. He campaigned about making things work for people, not so much as an ideologue. The Freedom Caucus is pretty ideological. President Trump, maybe not. Does he have any room to sort of bust out of the confines that Paul Ryan has found him in and make a different kind of coalition? Could he find some posse of Democrats who would come in and sort of, you know, work in triangle with the president and moderate Republicans to make something happen? Any chance of that, Sile?
Tom, it's going to be difficult. One of the things that defined Donald Trump during the campaign and defined his candidacy was a break from these orthodoxies. He wasn't a traditional limited government conservative in the way that the Freedom Caucus is, or even in the way that Speaker Ryan was. You know,
so is that not freedom to do something different for him?
That absolutely is, but clearly it's a lot harder to do this when you have to get something through Congress and when there are entrenched elements of your party that are wedded to this orthodoxy.
Yeah, but say, the heck with them. I'm gonna forget the Freedom Caucus, go with moderate Republicans and Democrats. Is there any chance, is there a snowball's chance of him doing that?
It's certainly possible. I don't discount the possibility that President Trump will decide that this way is not working. I'm going to try something very different. So far, he has surrounded himself with advisors, and he agree with Speaker Ryan's vision for the most part. And he had on healthcare deferred to him on the drafting of this legislation and the way it moved forward. It's entirely possible, like I said, that if he decides that this isn't working, that he tries a very different approach, not only working with moderate Republicans but potentially even Democrats on something like infrastructure. On the other hand, in this era, I think Democrats are so the politics on the Democratic side are so dynamite right now. They're so explosive when it comes to President Trump. It's going to be difficult to work with them. So he's got a tough road ahead.
Chris in Buda, Texas. Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a carpenter. My wife's a school teacher.
Yeah.
We have two young children. And before Obamacare, I was shopping for insurance because there was no way we could afford to add me to my wife's insurance because it was $350 a month just to add me.
Mm-hmm.
After Obamacare was passed, it turns out there's this really confusing law, part of it, that says that if anyone in your family gets insurance through your employer, then your entire family is excluded from being able to get any financial help, any subsidies of any kind, which means that I'm stuck having to buy from what the market has left. Now, before Obamacare, I was shopping and I could buy anywhere from like an $80 health savings account plan with like a $10,000 deductible to, for about $300, I could buy something with $25 copays and a $1,000 deductible.
Yep.
After Obamacare, the cheapest thing I can get is $350 a month with a $14,000 deductible. The solution here is to stop looking at insurance as the solution. Insurance is not going to lower the cost of health care. Insurance is a symptom of the cost of health care.
What do you want?
Nothing you can do to the insurance plan. What I want them to do, okay, well, first of all, we need to subsidize people who are intelligent enough to go to school and become doctors so that they don't have so much debt. We also need to change the way medical billing works, because right now, just to see a doctor, you have to sign a contract that says you agree to pay them anything they could possibly think of.
Yeah.
That's not fair. It's not right. What we need to do is change the way medical billing and the cost of the services works from the ground up. Just getting people on the rolls of an insurance company without looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis standpoint doesn't make any sense.
Chris, we've got it, and I appreciate your call there as a carpenter who's thinking hard about this and paying attention. Mary Agnes, what about Chris's complaint?
I think Chris raised excellent points. This provision, and it wasn't just in – it's not just in the Affordable Care Act. It was in the Republican plan, too. If you had an offer of insurance that you know something else you could qualify for, you would not be allowed to get those subsidies on either plan to purchase health insurance. There is a there are like 10 million people that are in the individual market trying to buy health insurance. Many of them hit the same roadblocks that Chris is talking about. So if we ever got to a point of compromise where Democrats and Republicans wanted to sit down and really fix problems, they have to look at people just like this. They're out in the market. They're on their own. They're not getting any of the subsidies to lower the premiums or help with the out-of-pockets. What's in it for them? How do we make it better for them? How do you get employers, insurers, in there to offer plans that would work? I mean, some of these deductibles, these out-of-pockets and copays are crazy. They're really high. And the thing about it is with the Republican plan, they're probably going to face the same hurdles.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
Sal, does Paul Ryan survive this?
Tom, yes, I think he does in the near future, simply because there's no alternative. In a word, the Freedom Caucus can repeal him, but they cannot replace him.
Mm. What about Donald Trump going forward here? I mean, he made so much of this. Can he just step around this now and say, oh, never mind, and just go on to tax reform and you know, no wound?
There is a wound. No doubt there is a wound. The part of the theory was that he would be able to bring people from the right-wing elements of his party along, the Freedom Caucus, because many constituents in their districts very much like him and respect him. And he does very well in those districts. So if he can't bring them along, then he's got to recalibrate his strategy. One thing that Republicans have been telling me since the health care bill was pulled was that President Trump could benefit by changing his approach. By being more active from the start, by not getting distracted by other issues, and not sending wayward tweets that capture headlines. And
that sounds like a personality replacement. That sounds like a tall order.
It is a tall order.
There he sits, and you heard Chuck Schumer saying, "Well, he didn't know it was in the bill." It sort of seemed that he didn't. He was asking people reportedly, "Like, is this a good bill?" At the last minute. Tax reform is up next. Is he more engaged on that? Is that more in his wheelhouse to really understand what's coming and what the dynamics are?
To your first question, he seems more enthusiastic about tax reform than he ever seemed about healthcare. He's been talking about it for the last few weeks on the road when he does these campaign-style rallies to keep his constituents mobilized and engaged. He's recently been saying things like, we want a very big tax cut. We cannot do that until we get healthcare out of the way. He's been talking about how he's eager to get healthcare done, not for the sake of getting healthcare done so much, but for the sake of moving on. So,
are the same divisions there in the GOP when it comes to tax reform? Is it going to have the same fractured party?
Yes, he absolutely will. Tax reform is extremely difficult. It's as difficult in many ways as healthcare, and in some ways more difficult. Republicans agree theoretically on the concept of a big tax cut and on tax reform. But the devil is always in the details. And yes, it seems like the various factions are empowered. The Freedom Caucus is going to want certain things. The moderates are going to want certain things. And then you have this big group called the Republican Study Committee in between them that also is going to be driving a bargain. So yes, it's going to be a monumental task. The last time something like this was done was 1986. Paul Ryan was in high school.
When do Americans get so tired of winning that they're bored with winning? That was the promise.
Not in the imminent future, it seems, on legislating.
Perhaps. Perhaps. We'll see what comes. Sahil Kapoor with Bloomberg News National reporter there. Thank you very much for being with us today, Sahil.
Great to be on.
And Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Terrific to have you. Thank you for joining us, Mary Agnes.
Thank you.
We'll look at pipelines when we come back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Trump is making a lot of big moves on the energy and environment front, or preparing to. Last week, he green-lighted the Keystone XL pipeline out of Canada after it was stopped by the Obama administration. Tomorrow, he's slated to sign a big executive order pushing domestic oil, coal, and gas, and reversing the Obama Clean Power Plan. We want to look at where Trump energy policy is going. You can join us. How do you see President Trump's moves here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter or Facebook, On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Jen DeLuey, energy and environment reporter for Bloomberg. Jen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Middlebury, Vermont, is a man who can fairly be called one of the president's biggest opponents on the environment, Bill McKibben, author, environmentalist, founder of the environmental group 350.org, distinguished scholar at Middlebury College. In 2011 and 12, he led protests against the Keystone XL pipeline in front of the White House, spent 3 days in jail in Washington. Bill McKibben, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you.
First, Jen, on the Keystone XL pipeline, this is the one that would bring tar sands oil out of Canada. There was so much controversy and resistance, and it got nixed. But it's what exactly has the president done? Is it really fully green-lighted, or what's happened, Jen?
Well, the president has really only given it authorization at the federal level. His State Department approved a permit that would allow the construction of this pipeline, which crosses the border with Canada. But there's so much more left to go in terms of pipeline approvals happening and pending at the state level. In Nebraska, for instance, there's not even a route approved. There are regulators there are going to spend the next 6 months or more talking about that, discussing that, weighing that. And you have potential litigation also in South Dakota, challenging the route through that state. So there's quite a bit more steps to go. This is just one level of approval that TransCanada needed to build the project.
Bill McKibben, you fought hard against the Keystone XL pipeline and for a time, even now, appeared maybe to have won. Do you think it will eventually, in the Trump years, be built?
I have no real idea, Tom. I mean, they're going to keep pressing on it, but with each month that goes by, the thing makes less and less. I mean, it made no sense 6 years ago, but, you know, in the last 6 years, the price of a solar panel's dropped in half. We've had the three hottest years ever measured on this earth, and the price of oil has fallen in half. So all those things make it into what was already a dumb idea, a ludicrous one that's being done only to kind of please the oil industry donors and friends of the president. But it's preposterous, but then a number of preposterous things seem to be happening in our country right at the moment.
I mean, you've paid close attention in the past. I don't know how closely you're following this now, Bill. Do you see a path, given the Republican majority on Capitol Hill, given Donald Trump in the White House, given what you know about the states involved here, do you see a path where this actually might happen and that oil, tar sands oil will come?
The Washington part they can do. I mean, they've basically done. But there are enormous forces on the ground, people like Jane Kleb in Bold, Nebraska, people like the Native American communities that fought so hard on the Dakota pipeline, those same forces are in play here. And unlike the Dakota one, this one isn't built yet. There's no pipe in the ground. So they've got a long ways to go. And frankly, one of the things that makes it less and less likely is the financing for it. Why anyone would want to pour money into this project at this point is beyond me, and there's more and more pushback against the banks that are trying because it's so clearly out of touch with the times. Look, yesterday at noon, the state of California set a new record. At noontime yesterday, 56% of the electricity in the state was coming from renewable energy. That's clearly the future. Building a pipeline for tar sands oil that's supposed to last for 50 or 60 years to pay back its backers, that's nuts.
Now, Jen, you're watching this closely. What is the industry, the energy industry, expecting here? I mean, they must be handicapping this all the time and, you know, going long or shorting or you name it, depending on whether those fossil fuels come into the system or not. Are people beginning to bet that it will happen or not, Jen?
Well, you know, the shippers that have contracted space on this pipeline, you know, supposedly they are holding firm. They've been used to waiting on this project. I mean, this TransCanada first applied, you know, almost 9 years ago to build this thing. So I think waiting is what they're used to getting. At the same time, we are seeing a lot more options come online for moving crude out of Canada. Other pipelines have been approved. So it's not quite the situation that you saw 8-9 years ago when, you know, these producers who are extracting oil sands crude out of Canada were desperately trying to find ways to bring it to market. Now they are seeing more options come online. And that's a real question for the developers of Keystone XL, whether this capacity is as urgently needed as it was 8 years ago.
Cole in Springfield, Illinois. You're on the air with Jen DeLoey and Bill McKibben. What do you see, Cole?
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. So what I see is that this is Canadian oil coming from, you know, the tar sands in Canada and going to Washington State, I believe, to be shipped elsewhere, like China and abroad.
So what's your point? I mean, I don't think it goes to Washington State, but what's your point there, Cole?
My point is that last week I heard President Trump talking about how this project is supposed to help reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Well, this is foreign oil.
This is a very good point. And it's not going to Washington State. It's going to the Gulf of Mexico. But the thing that makes it particularly funny is that the president has said about 175,000 times that it was, among other things, going to be run through American pipe and American steel.
Yeah.
And that was all. And last week, his administration said, oh, you know what, forget that. Build it with any pipe you want. Apparently, a lot of the pipe that's already been built is built with, you guessed it, Russian steel.
Russian steel, no less. But Bill, what's your interpretation of why Donald Trump is pushing for this?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump thinks that climate change is a Chinese hoax. He runs a party that's basically a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry. And they're going to do everything they can to try and keep the oil, coal, and natural gas industries happy. I mean, that's the one consistent thing in all their politics. This is the, you know, in the course of the next week, we're going to get rid of Obama's clean power plan to try and help the coal industry. And last week, we got rid of or started the process of getting rid of higher mileage standards for cars in a desperate effort to stop the demand destruction for gasoline that's clearly coming as people, you know, produce $30,000 electric cars that people want to buy.
Of course, that was a main plank from the Obama years and the American commitment to reducing CO2 and fighting climate change. Here was Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, Donald Trump's ABC yesterday with George Stephanopoulos, talking about what's coming, what the president will move on tomorrow.
Our action starting on Tuesday, shortly after the executive order, will make sure that whatever steps we take in the future will be pro-growth, pro-environment, but within the framework of the Clean Air Act, and it will be legal.
But will it bring back coal jobs?
I think absolutely it will. It will bring back manufacturing jobs across the country, coal jobs across the country.
Wind down the clean power plant. Now, that's supposed to be very complicated. Do you see coal jobs coming back? Is that what's driving this or something else?
Coal jobs have a number of problems stacked against them, and the coal industry does in general. Clean power plant is a piece of that, but it's a relatively small piece when you look at some of the other considerations. Coal jobs actually have been in decline for decades now, partly because in recent years demand has slumped because of other pollution rules targeting mercury and other traditional pollution. But then you do also have curbs on carbon dioxide. What is interesting is that utilities are making some of these changes away from coal toward natural gas and renewables simply because of price. Natural gas is now cheaper than coal in general. So there's already a cost mechanism, a market force that's pushing them away from coal. And in the mines themselves, even as you have slumping demand for coal domestically, in the mines themselves, you see a lot more automation. You see automated tools to extract coal, to mine coal, that's actually displacing a lot of workers. So there's a real question, even if Trump, can disband and undo the Clean Power Plan, a process that will take a couple of years and will be challenged in court, there's a real question of how you can really bring back jobs where it's automation that's pushing folks out of the mines, not just regulation.
But Jen, you're at Bloomberg News. I mean, you pay a lot of attention to business there. The Scott Pruitt claim here, the EPA administrator's claim, is that this is pro-growth when you let the oil run through the pipelines and sort of throw the traces off of fossil fuel development. Does the business community agree with that? Donald Trump has promised faster growth. If they do all these things, I mean, maybe it will trash the climate, but would it give them a short run or, some years of higher growth rates?
Well, certainly broad business groups and the companies that represent fossil fuels think so. I mean, they would like to see, many of the hurdles to development.
Yeah, but wait a minute. That's just for their bottom line. I mean, the GDP, much bigger than even an oil company.
There are jobs tied to petrochemical development that will increase in terms of in response to some of these regulatory changes if they happen. I think the broader question is what happens 10, 15, 20 years down the line when you have U.S. automakers competing to sell cars to a worldwide market, and when you have renewable developers that are trying to sell solar panels, try to erect wind
turbines.
You mean
they might be less competitive down the line if they lean back into fossil fuels now?
That's certainly the argument you hear, that we need to stay competitive, and the way we do that is, as a country, is by leading on climate.
RJ is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. RJ, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hey, Tom. I was just wanting to call. I had the question, does the administration have any sort of plan moving forward regarding, atmospheric science with the climate, considering signing all these bills, pushing forward like coal and dirty energy, basically.
Yeah. Mel McKibben, are they just putting a match to the climate, or what about the climate science?
Plan about atmospheric science. You ever see those three monkeys with the one with the hands over his eyes and his ears and his mouth? That's their plan.
See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, see nothing.
They're studying research. They're beginning to shut down funding for the satellites that monitor things like the rapidly diminishing ice at the poles. They're doing, they're even scrubbing the websites of language about climate change. It's the thing that cannot be mentioned anymore. And that's a shame because it's the single biggest fact on the planet we live. The New York Times today, on the front page, has a story about what they're describing as the greatest humanitarian disaster since World War II, the spreading drought across much of northern parts of Africa that's putting 20 million people at risk of famine. I mean, while we're talking today, the worst floods in the history of Peru have 700,000 people displaced from their homes. These are things that happen now every day around the world. Earlier this month in Kansas and Oklahoma, ironically the home of Scott Pruitt, we've seen the worst wildfires ever for this time of year in our country. They're calling it the Katrina of the plains. There's so much damage and devastation left. And yet in Washington, you'd think it was 1940 or 1950, full speed ahead, coal. I mean, the craziness of it is underlined by the fact that there's far more people now at work putting up solar panels than mining coal. That's where the jobs are if we want jobs. The only thing that we're protecting are the profit margins of a few fossil fuel barons, and that's it.
Angela in Lakeland, Florida. Thank you for calling, Angela. You're on.
Yes, sir. my understanding is that Mr. Trump, forgive me for not calling him president, also has financial holdings. He owns stock in the XL pipeline and in the North Dakota Access Pipeline. And that would be a very, very excellent incentive for him to have approved it, would it not?
Let me ask, Jen, what do you know? Does Donald Trump have a financial stake in these two pipelines?
He divested, his campaign officials told us during the campaign, he divested from his holdings for the developer of the Dakota Access Pipeline and some other projects. He certainly did have investments in this space prior to becoming president.
So how do you interpret his push here? Is it try and push up GDP? Is it, Bill McKibben would say, you know, he's beholden to the fossil fuel industry? How do you interpret it, Jen?
Well, certainly for you know, the coal miners that he has promised to, you know, he's promising to bring back their jobs. And of course, it is an open question whether he can do any of that. But those are the folks that helped elect him to the White House. I mean, you have folks in Pennsylvania, voters in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and in Ohio who for whom coal and industrial development is and manufacturing is incredibly important. And I think he does feel some need to serve those people, those voters. And of course, oil and gas and coal companies are strategically aligned with the Republican Party, you know, and have been for some time. So I don't think it's a surprise.
Bill, do these moves, speaking of alignment, do they kill American alignment with the possibility of reversing climate change or stopping the rate of change?
Yeah, absolutely. America is now a rogue nation, the rogue nation around climate change. Even as countries like China are now going full bore, putting renewables in as fast as they can, official government policy here is, if not to formally abrogate the Paris Climate Accords, then to do all the things that would make it impossible for us to meet the targets that we pledged to meet 2 years ago. So they are in full ownership now of climate change. They've made the most significant wager that any administration's ever made, which is that physics doesn't work, and they get to own the absolute worst set of disasters that we've ever seen.
Well, there's not much satisfaction in that if things go south and people suffer. What about the market? We hear people saying, Bill, that the market's going to come in here. As you say, that there's such a compelling case for alternative energy, it's going to happen anyway.
Renewable energy will happen. The problem, Tom, is that it won't happen fast enough on its own to close the gap that global warming's created. We need to make that happen. That's why there'll be hundreds of thousands of Americans in D.C. on April 29th for this next big climate march, because this movement will continue to push for real action. Whether we can do it in the face of Trump, well, we're going to find out.
Bill McKibben, author, environmentalist, founder of 350.org. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, man.
And Jen DeLowey, energy and environment reporter for Bloomberg News. Jen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Maeve Pagess, Sarah Platt, Allison Poley, Tanya Raleigh, and James Ross, with help from Calvin Henry, Grace Seegers, and Michael DiSocio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiff, and I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.